Hey, and welcome back to the preparing your enterprise for Windows 10 as a service jumpstart. Apologies for not starting off with my mic plugged in there. That is the first time that's ever happened, and incredibly embarrassing. So we'll just move on past that. However, this is the next section, which is around deploying Windows 10 as a service. And Michael Niehaus from the product marketing team is in to explain how we can go through the process of doing our Windows 10 deployments. But before we do that, Michael, do you want to introduce yourself very briefly to the audience?
Sure, I can do that. My name's Mike Niehaus. I'm a senior product marketing manager. I've been doing this for a few years now, talking about how organizations should deploy and manage Windows inside of their companies.
Yeah, and it's fair to say that you've got, well, rather a ton of deployment experience, actually, frankly.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a while with the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and even before that in enterprise IT. So I've been doing it for, way too many years now.
Yeah,
it's going on 20 years, so.
So you've seen.
Been a while.
You've seen things change very recently then, I guess,
with
Windows 10.
People look at me with blank faces when I talk about deploying Windows 95 using floppy disks. And that's a sign that you're old.
Yeah, that's one of those things where.
Things have come a long way since then, fortunately. We've got new ways of doing things, so that's one of the topics for Windows 10. Talk about what's new.
Yeah. So let's start off with our deploying Windows 10 agenda, and I guess the very first thing is things have changed from that kind of previous process of maybe the only option really being to delete what you had and then start afresh. We've got some new options.
Yeah, we've been talking about that for quite a few years now. That we have this wipe and load process that we've been teaching companies to do using tools like the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, System Center Configuration Manager, the ADK, to go through and capture the data and settings from an existing machine, deploy a new OS image to the machine, inject the drivers for that particular model of machine, and then reinstall the applications and put all the data back. So that process is well understood, and people have been doing that for their Windows 7 deployments to get from Windows XP to Windows 7. So they're familiar with it. They know how it works. They understand it. And the inclination for most people is, oh, I'm going to go to Windows 10. I'm going to do it the exact same way. But we want to talk about the possibility of doing it differently, using an in-place upgrade, so that you really let Windows do most of the work. Instead of doing the traditional, you run setup.exe with command line switches, telling it to automatically migrate all the settings, all the data, all the applications, and even the drivers that are present on the current machine. So you can take your existing Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1 machine and upgrade it directly to Windows 10. We've been doing that a lot with the consumer machines already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
with the release of Windows 10, we've got millions of people that have already gone through that process. Now we want to encourage companies to do the same thing. So shifting from wipe and load to in-place upgrade. That doesn't mean giving up on the deployment tools that you're using today, because you can still drive this using task sequences from MDT or Config Manager. So they're adding support for this new deployment option. You're just putting less emphasis on creating an image, deploying drivers, reinstalling applications, because all of that's really handled for you.
So I guess really you're putting less emphasis on the aspects that have traditionally been the time suckers, the things that have really kind of taken up a lot of the cost of doing a deployment. With the new approaches of being able to do in-place upgrades, we're actually thinking it might save companies quite a lot of time and money and effort in their deployment plan.
Yeah, because the deployment projects, you spend a lot of time engineering. You need to build your image, you need to build up your infrastructure, but here it's much lighter weight. So you don't need a custom image, you don't need any new infrastructure. You can do these in-place upgrades leveraging your existing tools, even the existing versions of your existing tools, because it's not using the ADK, it's not using boot images. All of this just runs setup.exe from within the current operating system to upgrade you to the new OS. It does most of the work for you.
Yeah, it's been a pretty reliable process. I mean, we've not only seen this happen with all of the consumer upgrades, but also looking inside of what's happened inside of Microsoft. as one of those deployment rings. We've actually seen this happening pretty regularly with our own machines internally. So,
and insiders have seen it too, because the insider builds, each new build that's gone out is leveraging an in-place upgrade to migrate you from whatever you're running to the next build. So most of the insiders, a lot of whom are IT pros themselves, already have a fairly good level of experience with this from the insider process.
Yeah.
The question is, well, are you willing to take that and do it broadly?
Yeah.
To do a large scale deployment of Windows 10. We have quite a few customers trying that out. Our TAP customers are early adopters who are going through that process now. We're trying to gather more feedback from them just to say, here's how it went for them. It's not to say that it's a 100% answer. We do need to talk a little bit more about some of the gotchas and some of the scenarios where you can't do an in-place upgrade and you still need to do the traditional wipe and load, but we do think that in-place will work well for a large number of customers. You also need to think about, as you have made the migration from Windows 7 to Windows 10, how are you then going to go from Windows 10 to the next upgrade that we release? Mm-hmm. And initially, we'll be leveraging in-place upgrade for that as well. So you'll need to get into this rhythm of deployment. We had this debate when we were looking at the agenda originally. Should we talk about Windows as a service first? Mm-hmm. Should we talk about deployment first? Mm-hmm. But really, the two of them blend together. So for this first session, we'll focus on the deployment side, but then we'll have to circle back in the Windows as a service servicing discussion and talk about how really this has an impact.
Completely interweaved is the thing. And I noticed as well, we've got the idea of provisioning as well, which is, again, something new for those devices which maybe come with an operating system on already, or in fact, do come with an operating system on, but it's not an enterprise operating system, it's not configured for the company. How does provisioning kind of come into play with deployment?
Yeah, for provisioning, we want to be able to take a new Windows 10 device and transform it into an enterprise device. So rather than rebuilding the image or rebuilding the machine as soon as you get it out of the box and plug it in, we want you to be able to take whatever came on it, add your enterprise configuration to it, transform the SKU of Windows to the enterprise SKU if you want to do that, and you're set to go. So how can we easily take that device and turn it into an enterprise device? Similar to what you would do with a phone. You don't re-image a phone when you first get it out of the box and turn it on the first time. You just configure it to put the necessary enterprise bits on it. We've got a couple of these dynamic provisioning scenarios to talk about, so we'll get deeper into that as we go through this session.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting kind of parallel to draw with how you think about servicing hardware as well. It used to be that you would take a piece of hardware and you'd actually have somebody that would be able to swap out the hard drive, swap out the memories. But actually, as we start to move towards slimmer, lighter, more mobile devices, that's become much harder. And I guess there's a kind of a parallel between software servicing and also hardware servicing there, in that you don't maybe necessarily need such an invasive procedure into actually working with the operating system. And I guess that's where provisioning packages provide kind of a nice, lighter option. And of course, they're really good in smaller organizations that maybe don't have all of the big infrastructure, things like on-premises servers potentially, things like configuration manager, any deployment mechanisms. They can work completely independently of other options. So that should be useful for folks. So let's think about moving in place.
Sure. And so we need to dig in a little deeper to make sure that you understand what the options are and what the restrictions are. So we'll start off by talking about just kind of the details, the nuts and bolts of how this works. First, you can use in-place upgrade to move from Windows 7, Windows 8, or Windows 8.1. For consumers, in-place upgrade means going out to Windows Update, downloading the bits over the internet, and initiating the install from there, just like it's a normal update. Enterprises really want more control than that. So for enterprises, they would typically be downloading the media for Windows 10 from the Volume License Service Center, their typical volume license media, and then using Config Manager or MDT to run a task sequence to do the upgrade. It uses a standard Windows 10 image, the install.wim, off of that media, so you don't modify the image. You use the standard install.wim that's provided. And that's really all you need to do. It's automatically going to migrate everything, apps, data, settings, and you're left with a Windows 10 machine that's ready to go.
And just on that point, we were just talking just before we got here, and there's some folks on the Q&A that have actually asked, if I've got some devices which are maybe running Windows 7, Windows 8, and they're domain joined, but they're not, they're domain joined, but they haven't, aren't receiving updates from Windows Update for the to move on to Windows 10. The way to get around that is to actually use the media download tool to create media and go to each machine and individually upgrade them.
Right, yeah. On the main Windows 10 webpage at Microsoft.com, you can find the link to the media creation tool. You download that, which is kind of a version of setup itself. Yeah. It will ask you, do you want to upgrade this machine or do you want to create media? If you say you want to upgrade the machine, it'll go ahead and download the pieces and initiate an in-place upgrade to take that current, say, a Windows 7 professional machine and upgrade it to Windows 10. If you say you want to create media, then it's going to ask you for either a place to save the ISO or a USB key so that it can place the bits there, and then you can use that on multiple machines. That media is basically upgrade media that you can use to take advantage of the free upgrade offer for the first year. For enterprises that have software assurance, they typically wouldn't do that. They would instead use the volume license media on the volume license service center to do the same basic process, still doing an in-place upgrade, but leveraging KMS and Mac keys to activate the upgraded OS, whereas the free upgrade has to reach out to the Windows Store to get a license for Windows 10 and then do an activation over the internet as well.
Yep.
So there are differences depending on whether you are a software assurance customer or if you're looking to take advantage of the free upgrade offer. But for those looking to take advantage of the free upgrade, the media creation tool will get around all of the checks that look, is this machine domain joined? Is this machine MDM managed? So that's the simplest way to get Windows 10 on those devices. There are checks in that Get Windows 10 process that make sure that we don't present any notifications to users on domain joined machines. There are also restrictions on the deployment of the updates to those machines. They're not offered. Those updates aren't offered through WSUS, so that we don't accidentally offer an upgrade to one of them. So they do need to kind of go through some extra hoops if they want to get it from Windows Update, but the media creation tool is the simpler path.
Yeah. And it makes sure that you guys are still completely in control of what's happening inside of your businesses, so it's exactly the right way to go. If we just segue back to the reason we're here, having answered that question, which I know got asked a lot inside of the Q&A, let's just go through the process. We're kind of thinking around how we kind of simplified that that process for the prior experience that we've had.
Yeah, the upgrade process that we're using really has been around for quite a while. I mean, it's the same process that we use to go from even Windows XP to Windows Vista, and then Vista to 7, 7 to 8, 8 to 8.1. We've never supported going back multiple releases. We realized that that was kind of silly. Since most people are on Windows 7, we need to support the OSs that people are actually using. So we had to add support for Windows 7 on up. But we also had worked with customers who wanted to upgrade from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1, and we helped them with that process just to learn what types of issues that enterprises were going to encounter. That taught us some, but we really wanted to learn even more than that. So we worked with a couple of customers to go directly from 7 to 8.1 via an in-place upgrade. We just gave them some private updates to enable that, and then helped them to see what additional changes we needed to make in Windows 10 to make this easier. So we've added additional command line switches, we've added additional driver management options, logging options, additional automation capabilities. So really we've taken all of the learnings from those previous go-arounds and put it into Windows 10. The process overall is now reasonably smooth. There are some issues that we'll still run into, especially with third-party disk encryption tools. Mm-hmm. So we will still continue working with those vendors to figure out now, because the machine is encrypted, how do we upgrade the OS to allow setup to replace the operating system with a new one and have all that work with these third-party tools? So we've been working with the ISVs, which is one of the learnings that we had as we were testing this out with Windows 7, so that we can enable that scenario without decrypting the machine.
Yeah.
With BitLocker, we always handle that automatically. It just works.
Yeah.
You upgrade the machine and it re-enables BitLocker at the end of the process. No decryption's ever done. You never even have to worry about it. But with these other third-party tools, it's not quite that clean. We did see that this week there was one of the big ISVs for those tools published basically their own version of a KB article that says, here's how to upgrade to Windows 10 with our software still installed, with the disk still encrypted. So you're starting to see that information be released from these ISVs that we've worked with for the last year to perfect these processes.
Yeah, and I guess it's always a good time to make sure that you've got a really good relationship with your vendors and actually go out to them and start asking the folks who make the software that you're reliant on, what are your plans for supporting Windows 10? Just to make sure that they're hearing that information from their customers and make sure that it's kind of on their cycles to actually think about their Windows 10 compatibility. Sure. So what are our options for actually doing the upgrade?
So we want to drive the in-place upgrade in a way that you can control, and we've got mechanisms available to do that using task sequences. So if we could switch over to the slide, just to give a visual of what this would look like. If you're using Config Manager, the vNext version that will be coming out later this year will add a new upgrade task sequence. MDT 2013 Update 1 that's due out sometime this month, soon, will add an upgrade task sequence as well. So you'll be able to leverage these task sequences out of the box to drive the process. Now, if you're using Config Manager 2012 or 2012 R2, you can still do this because behind the scenes, it's just running setup.exe with a bunch of command line switches. So the Config Manager team posted an example task sequence that you can import into older versions of Config Manager 2 to do the same thing. So you do have options for doing this. The task sequence itself really is more of a skeleton. It runs the upgrade process, but then it has steps before and after to let you customize that. Maybe you want to upgrade other software at the same time. You might have new versions of antivirus software or firewalls or whatever other things need to be tweaked either before or after the upgrade. You just hook that into the task sequence. So we put in placeholders to show here's where you can put this stuff.
Yeah, and I guess it also gives you the option to be able to remove some software if that's something that your testing has determined actually we no longer need to be using that, we can take it away.
Sure.
So it may be that there's a replacement feature that's actually just directly within Windows 10 and you no longer need that particular option. So it gives you a lot of control over your deployment.
Yeah, and that does become kind of one of those discussion points that if you're going to do an in-place upgrade, we're going to preserve all your apps. Well, what if you wanted to upgrade all of your apps at the same time? Mm-hmm. At some point, you're going to spend more time upgrading the apps than you do upgrading the OS. So there are some tipping points where you're going to look at this and say, you know what, I'm just going to do a traditional wipe and load because I want to change so much at once. Mm-hmm. Maybe once I get to Windows 10 via wipe and load, at that point, I then switch over to doing in-place upgrades to stay current. But I could leverage a wipe and load to do a mass change that's more than just the operating system.
And I guess those kind of tipping points will depend on how you're managing application lifecycle to a certain extent inside of your organization. If you're heavily managing your application lifecycle, say through ConfigMan, and you're regularly deploying updates out to applications anyway, well, actually doing an in-place upgrade of Windows might be better because those applications are going to be just continuing that upgrade cycle, and you don't have to go back and think about how do we change our application lifecycle management processes as well as our operating system processes.
Yeah, and we certainly hope that organizations don't wait 3 years before deploying new apps, just like we hope they don't spend 3 years before they deploy a new OS. So being able to use Config Manager and tools like that to deploy application updates avoids having to do those bigger forklift style migrations where you upgrade everything at once. But if you're in that state today, well, you can do that process leveraging the traditional deployment.
So when do we actually, when do we need to go for the full in place, the full wipe and load?
The biggest thing for most customers is if they're looking to change from x86 to x64, a 32-bit OS to a 64-bit OS, they'll need to do a wipe and load. In-place upgrade doesn't support changing OS architecture. A lot of customers have deployed Windows 7 to machines that were Windows 8 logo certified, so they supported UEFI and some of the new secure boot capabilities. But since they were deploying Windows 7, they'd turn all that stuff off and deploy using the legacy BIOS emulation. So now they're talking about, well, I want to turn that back on as part of the deployment process, but that's not something you can do via an in-place upgrade either. Yeah. You would need to keep the machine configured exactly the same way that it is today. So if you're using the legacy BIOS emulation, you would upgrade, it's still going to be using the legacy BIOS emulation. As a result, you're not going to have secure boot enabled for you because that does require UEFI native booting, but the mechanism for changing that requires hardware reconfiguration, disk reconfiguration, different partition structure, so it's not something that we can achieve via an upgrade. If you want to do it, traditional deployment can be used, but even with that, you would probably end up backing up the user data to a network location, reconfiguring the machine, repartitioning it, reinstalling the OS, and then pulling the data back down. So it can be done, but it's not something to do via an in-place upgrade.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that folks should really be thinking about doing. If you've got UEFI in the machine and you're not actually taking advantage of it and you're using BIOS emulation, you're missing out on some really key security features there. Things like the ability to do secure boot and measured boot, but not only that, actually using UEFI provides such a level of trust into the operating system that it can actually be good to be able to do away with, say, maybe the BitLocker pin. That can actually help you get through that particular process. So it's definitely worth, if you've got UEFI inside of a machine, really taking advantage of UEFI and not just relying on the BIOS emulation. We had a bunch of questions as well inside of the chat about dual boot and multi-booting. Again, not something that can just be upgraded using setup.exe. Presumably the partition structure is a bit complicated.
It can be, yeah. But we can't guarantee 100% what's going to happen. Like, let's say you have a machine, these IT pros that are responsible for supporting multiple versions of an OS may have one machine that has Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1 on it, and they boot between the different OS versions. When we initiate an upgrade to Windows 10, we know that we can upgrade whichever OS you selected, whichever image you selected, but we can't guarantee that the boot environment would still be able to boot all the other operating systems. So it probably will work, but you may need to do some tweaks after the fact to get the other operating systems that are still on the machine to boot as well. So it's not so much that it's not supported, it's just one of those things where we look at it and say, yeah, you should probably be doing that one more manually and expect that you might need to do a couple extra steps after the fact to get everything booting the way you want it again. For those that have switched away from those multi-boot scenarios to using virtual machines instead, mm-hmm. No issue. So that's what I've done years ago. The headaches of dual boot machines just weren't worth it anymore. It was easier to just have a bunch of VMs and I can switch between VMs without worry.
Yeah, it does make for a much, much easier process. Also, I think the use of Windows to go and boot from VHD, that needs to be done via a wipe and load style upgrade versus setup.exe.
Yeah, and people have tried that already, and they get a nice error message that says, nope, you can't do this. So for those installation options, basically, you do need to deploy a new image out to the machine. With Windows to Go, that basically means building a new USB stick. Yeah. With boot to VHD, you can deploy a new VHD and set up the machine to boot into that one. then you basically have a dual boot environment set up. So that is an option, but you wouldn't be able to upgrade your existing boot from VHD OS. We've seen people that try to get creative with that and take their boot from VHD, attach it to a virtual machine, upgrade it, and then remove it and put it back. Ooh, you're brave, but it has worked for some people. It's just not something that we would sign off on and say, yeah, we support that.
Yeah.
So you're kind of out there on your own for those types of scenarios.
That's going to require some custom support inside of your own organizations
to
actually enable that. I guess this also means that if I'm one of those organizations that builds a really good gold image, I can continuously run setup.exe on it and then keep sysprepping it to keep it up to date.
There's some gotchas with that one. So that may be a temptation for an organization to say, I've got this Windows 7 image that I've put a lot of work into and I'm really happy with it. Now I want to deploy Windows 10. So let me take that Windows 7 image, deploy it to a machine, upgrade it to Windows 10, sysprep it. No. Sysprep will fail. Sysprep doesn't support running on an upgraded OS. So if you're going to do the traditional deployment where you need to build your own gold image, you do need to start from scratch with Windows 10. Fortunately, most people are using MDT or something like it today to do an automated OS image creation process. So really, they just need to drop in Windows 10, update their task sequence to use Windows 10, and push the button to build a new image. So it's fairly easy to do that.
Yeah, it shouldn't be one of those things that slows you down. But if you're maybe using monolithic imaging or something, it's possibly something you really want to be thinking about a little bit more. So in terms of the systems that actually support doing the deployments, whereabouts do we stand with those?
We're in pretty good shape for System Center Configuration Manager 2007. Will require a hotfix. That one will be available in the coming months. Config Manager 2012 and 2012 R2, the service packs that were released back in May, I believe, added most of the support needed. There is a cumulative update that came out, I think last week, that adds the final pieces of support for Windows 10. So you'll certainly be able to manage and deploy Windows 10 using those existing releases. The vNext version of Config Manager, which will be out later this year, adds the upgrade task sequence template that we talked about before and some additional Windows 10 functionality. So you'll want to start thinking about deploying that later this year. But if you do want to do Windows 10 in the near term, you can certainly use your existing releases. You just need the necessary service packs and updates.
Yeah.
MDT 2013 doesn't support Windows 10 at all. Don't try it. It won't work. The update one release that's coming out hopefully soon, but definitely sometime this month, will fully support Windows 10 image creation, image deployment, and in-place upgrade.
Yeah, and it's I've been kind of using some of the internal versions of that, and actually it seems to be working really well. So it seems to be a very good kind of place for us to be. And obviously the things that are coming along next are the upgraded task sequences, the upgrade task sequences that are going to be brought directly in there, and the kind of specific configuration of Windows 10 devices.
Right, with Config Manager vNext, they want to provide new functionality specifically for Windows 10. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that new functionality isn't something that older versions of Config Manager know anything about. So in order to take advantage of new features, upgrade to vNext. But for just basic management and basic deployment scenarios, existing Config Manager versions will work fine.
So should we actually take a look at doing an in-place upgrade?
I thought it would be useful.
Kind of cool.
So if we can switch over to my machine here. What I've got here is a Windows 7 client. And it's a Config Manager client. It has a couple of advertisements, a couple of deployments targeting it. And you can really see that there's not much difference. I have a wipe and load traditional task sequence and an upgrade task sequence. So from a user experience perspective, there's really no difference. It's just an operating system deployment. But to initiate an upgrade, I can click install, and it will begin to download all of the pieces locally to the machine and then run setup to do the actual upgrade. So it's very simple. The upgrade step, if we actually watch it behind the scenes in Task Manager, we would eventually see setup.exe and its sub-processes, setup host and others, that eventually will kick off to initiate that. We can come back and check on this one in a little bit, because it will have to download the bits before that process gets started. So while that's thinking about it, let me switch over to another Windows 7 client and do the same thing via MDT. So I can initiate MDT from the deployment share just by running lighttouch.vbs as normal and select a new task sequence to do the in-place upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 10. Give it a couple of seconds to gather information, and then we can choose the task sequence. So I can select Windows 10 Enterprise X64 upgrade, click Next. There really aren't too many other details required. I do need to put in credentials. And then I can start. It's the same basic task sequence, not too many steps in it. It will quickly get into setup, and we'll be able to see in Task Manager the processes kick off. If I click on the right tab, so it shows that it's running upgrade OS. We can see setup.exe running, setup host, setup prep, all the normal processes that are executed as part of the upgrade. So it's already into the upgrade. While that runs, let's switch over to the server side and look at what those task sequences actually are. First, in the case of MDT, if we were to look at a traditional task sequence, it's fairly lengthy. If we were to expand out all these groups, we'd see that there's probably 100 or so steps in a traditional wipe and load task sequence. But if we compare that with an upgrade task sequence, it's really short. Some validation steps, a little bit of copying for scripts, and some post-processing to maybe install updates and install applications. But really, most of the work is done in this one single step to upgrade Windows. We specify what operating system we want to install. We can have it dynamically update itself with the latest compatibility details from Windows Update. Or we can, by default, choose not to do that. Maybe you don't want thousands of machines going out to Woo and downloading bits. So you get options like that. Any errors that occur during the process, maybe it fails because there's a compatibility issue or insufficient disk space or something like that, we can capture those errors and report those back through the monitoring capabilities in MDT as well. To look at the same thing in Config Manager, what's been added in Config Manager vNext is we can say that we want to create a new task sequence, and there's an option here to upgrade an operating system from an upgrade package. I've already done that. The end result is a task sequence that's very short again. Check readiness just to make sure that we've got the necessary hardware requirements met. We perform the upgrade, specifying the image that we want to upgrade to. We can add additional drivers. We can do the dynamic update if we want to. So same basic options that are exposed through the setup.exe command lines, you can choose through the built-in upgrade OS step. If we look back on our initial client, we can see that setup is now running. So setup.exe and its child processes, setup host and setup prep. So it's already downloaded all the bits locally and it's running the upgrade. Now, in both cases, the task sequences tell setup not to display any UI at all. Be quiet. So it just sits in the background doing its work. So all the end user really sees is the task sequence progress dialog. So from an end user perspective, until it does that initial reboot into Windows PE where you see a black screen with the progress dialog, It's not going to look any different than a traditional task sequence.
So it actually feels like a very easy and comfortable way of being able to push that upgrade out there and be able to get people to do it. They just need to, I guess, with MDT go and actually start the process themselves as opposed to it being a zero touch, which you could do with right. in Figma.
Yeah, it's mostly a question of scale. If I am an IT pro that needs to upgrade 100 machines, I can do that by walking to each machine, running lighttouch.vbs, choosing the task sequence, and then off to the next machine. If I need to do this on tens of thousands of machines, I don't really want to walk to tens of thousands of machines. So then you can use Config Manager with its capabilities of pushing that out to machines instead. So that's really the differentiation between the two. The end process that's being performed is the same in both cases. It's just a question of, can I do it remotely? Do I need to visit each machine?
So just to move us through the slides, just to make sure that everything is there and we don't miss any of the points that we had in there. Enhancements to existing tools. We've got new ADK for Windows
right.
10. Minor updates to System Center 2012 to add some support. And also MDT 2013 update 1 to add the support as well. A few folks on the Q&A have been saying, oh, can we try update 1 preview? I think the answer is kinda.
Yeah. The initial release of the MDT 2013 update 1 preview came out with the first insider release.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And a lot of things have changed since then, including the version number on Windows changed from like 6.4 to 10.0, and that broke a lot of things. So we knew that was coming in MDT and tried to fix as many things as we could, but we missed some things. Mm-hmm. So right away, when the first builds came out with the 10.0 version numbers, we found a few critical issues and we addressed those. But there were more beyond that. So there are some updated scripts on the Microsoft deployment, MS deployment blog that get you around the most critical issues. But the additional fixes will come out with the full released version within the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and it really isn't far off. So unless you've got a really pressing need to go and try today, then probably just give it a few days. And also, in terms of minimal changes to the existing processes, everything you already know still works. There's no reason to not be able to use the existing processes. You don't need to go away and think, right, I need to spend months skilling up on how to be able to do this deployment. We need to go and build a new deployment plan. You can probably look at the deployment plans you've used previously, and they might well be what you need again.
Yeah, and from a task sequence perspective, if you were to try to compare a new Windows 10 task sequence with an old Windows 7 task sequence, unmodified, before you tweaked it, mm-hmm. they're going to look exactly the same. So
yeah.
It's not like you need to learn a bunch of changes in the process. It hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, we've been very careful to try and make sure that very little has to change, but that gives you more options and flexibility so that you can reassess some of the, some of the assumptions that you made in the past to see whether they're still valid in today's environment.
Yeah, most of the changes are just with plumbing. So we have new versions of Windows PE, new versions of USMT, new versions of the tools that are used by the task sequences, but those changes are really transparent.
Yeah, they're pretty good updates. So in terms of app and device compatibility, that's normally the thing that kind of, as soon as people go start to plan their deployment, the very first thing that comes up is, oh, my enterprise apps, are they going to be working in this situation?
Yeah, and overall, compatibility is going to be a good
really
story.
Good. Yeah.
Because any machine capable of running Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1 should be able to run Windows 10 without any issue. There are some very small exceptions to that. Like if you're running Pentium D processors with Windows 7 x64, no, it's not going to run Windows 10 x64. It would run Windows 10 x86, but it doesn't include the processor instructions necessary for Windows 10 x64, just like it didn't include the necessary instructions to run Windows 8.1 x64. So there are some little gotchas like that that are called out in the system requirements doc for Windows 10. But for most enterprises, 99%+ of your machines are going to be able to run Windows 10 without issue.
Yeah.
So hardware-wise, not too concerned. There will be some driver updates, so that's generally going to happen with each new OS release, but shouldn't be a big deal overall. That then leads us to software. For desktop apps, we expect high compatibility again because we're not really making any significant changes to the Win32 subsystem that these apps run in.
Yeah.
We don't change that much, we don't break that much. Mm-hmm. Plus, we're getting all of the telemetry and feedback through the Insider program that Bill talked about before. So as we encounter issues during the development process, we can tweak Windows to make sure that we fix those problems before the broad population ever sees these Windows 10 releases.
Yeah, and I guess we might see some of the same kind of issues that we saw as people move from XP to Windows 7, where the developers of the applications had done some very weird things, like they were checking for specific operating system versions. And we put a lot of effort into explaining to ISVs and to app builders inside of enterprises that actually that's not necessarily the best idea. So hopefully a lot of those things
are going to work. We kind of came to our own realization that we can talk until we're blue in the face and developers still find creative ways of breaking things. So we go out of our way in Windows 10 to not tell apps that they're running on Windows 10. If an app gets updated for Windows 10 and adds a manifest saying that I support Windows 10, then the OS will tell it the truth and say, yes, you're running on Windows 10. But otherwise, it's going to say, you're running on Windows 7. So apps that do those types of version checks really won't even know that they're running on Windows 10. They'll still think that they're running on Windows 7. Good way of solving the compatibility issues, and at the same time, not requiring developers to go through all their code and make sure that they haven't accidentally put in the wrong type of check.
Yeah, and there's, I guess, the other types of apps that we support. I mean, one of the nice things about Windows is it's becoming one of the best platforms for application compatibility because the apps are going to have the ability to basically come from almost anywhere. But in terms of one of those other places, Windows Store applications, if folks have invested in a Windows Store application, again, I'm guessing it's just going to work.
Yeah, the good thing with the Windows Store apps is we have the Windows Store, which has hundreds of thousands of applications in it. So we have the install files for all those applications. So as we come out with new Windows builds, we can run automated tests on all of those to install them, launch them, run through standard operations, and be able to find, did it crash? Mm-hmm. We also have all the telemetry through the Insider process to be able to see any application issues that might have slipped through the cracks. So we think Windows Store apps overall are going to be pretty solid. That certainly there are new capabilities being added, but for those existing apps, as long as the existing capabilities continue to work unchanged, then the apps continue to work unchanged.
And the apps obviously in Windows 10 look just like a Win32 application, well, very much like a Win32 application as they're running. They both coexist on the desktop. You can easily move data between them. It kind of feels like a very natural approach.
It's very seamless. They all run in Windows now, so you can have a modern application running alongside a typical desktop application, and it's hard to tell the two apart.
Yeah, I must admit, I actually do that for most of my day, and I really don't really notice any difference now between the two applications at all.
A typical person's not going to notice, oh, that calculator application is a modern app. It's not the old Win32 calculator.
Yeah.
All they're going to notice is, hey, it's got a lot of new features.
Yeah.
So, big feature in Windows 10, we improved the calculator.
Yeah.
The other item that we need to talk about is Internet Explorer.
Yes. Yeah.
Because that becomes a big challenge for organizations. How are my web apps, how are my web pages going to work with Windows 10? So first of all, we will include Windows 10, in Windows 10, we'll include IE 11 exactly as it is today on Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 with all the enterprise mode capabilities. So organizations that have already made the migration to Windows 7 plus IE 11, taking advantage of enterprise mode, can be assured that all of that will continue to work on Windows 10. We do have a new browser as well. We've got Edge available to run new web pages, new websites, and to access the internet. But for those legacy enterprise apps, they may want to continue using IE 11. As part of the enterprise mode features, we did add in Windows 10 the ability to redirect from one to the other. Mm-hmm. So if a user who's using Edge for all of their typical browsing tries to go to a corporate application that doesn't support Edge and modern HTML5, it will pop up and tell them they need to run Internet Explorer again. So it's a single click to get them to back into Internet Explorer to use that application.
Yeah, and that really means that you don't have to give them, you don't have to revert to having Internet Explorer as the default browser. They can have all of the nice experiences that come with Edge and that will come with Edge as we go forward as well, because Edge is a is an app in and of itself. It's a universal Windows app, and therefore it's available through the Microsoft Store and has that has all of the capabilities that any universal store application has in order to be able to do its updates and to be able to kind of access websites and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so for organizations that haven't yet made the move to Internet Explorer 11, mm-hmm. that's really the first step to Windows 10. So it's really important to get that underway now, because Windows 7 won't support older versions of IE after January 2016. So mm-hmm. time's running out to get to IE 11 on Windows 7. But once you've gotten to IE 11, the web problem will mostly be non-existent with Windows 10. So fairly easy to get to Windows 10 after you've made that leap.
Yeah, and one of the things that I did a while ago was I actually sat down with one of our enterprise customers when they were here on Microsoft campus. I won't name the company for obvious reasons. But they had a bunch of applications internally that just weren't functioning inside of Internet Explorer. Introduced them to enterprise mode, and within about 3 minutes, we'd actually managed to solve all of their compatibility problems, which were preventing them from being able to move on to a new version of the browser, being able to move forward with an operating system deployment. So it's a really, really powerful feature set that enterprise mode actually introduces. And it does everything to give you complete control over how you can manage browser compatibility. And we have a ton of other information on the Microsoft Virtual Academy that will go into lots and lots of depth as to how to configure and work with enterprise mode. So go take a look at some of those courses for much, much more in-depth information. In terms of application compatibility testing, I think we're kind of going to need to see and think about ways that we actually need to change our approaches there.
Yeah, we need to get to a point where organizations are comfortable enough that we're not going to break things so that they can focus their testing just on truly mission-critical items. If you're running an app that is absolutely critical to the operation of your business, no matter what we tell you, you're going to test it for good reason. It's critical. You need to test it. But you have thousands of applications inside of most organizations, and you can't tell me that thousands of applications are critical, that there are less important ones. So what we want to try to encourage for organizations is to kind of build their own internal flighting mechanism so that you can do a staged deployment of a new Windows 10 upgrade to a group of users. And if they run into an application issue, they can just report it to the help desk. We don't expect it to happen often, but it's not to say it will never happen, but certainly the cost of doing all that upfront testing, we don't think it's going to be worth it in a lot of scenarios. So by doing it more reactively, by leveraging your own flighting mechanism, getting feedback from the users back into the help desk to let you then investigate the issue. Maybe you need to get an update for that application or apply a shim or some other something like that. You can do that more reactively rather than proactively and save a lot of time and effort at the same time.
Yeah, and there's all the usual ways that you kind of think about doing that inside of an enterprise. The one that comes to mind for me is that actually, to be able to do that testing, I'd probably provide a bunch of VMs for people to be able to use on a daily basis, and then we'd be able to see that. And if there was a problem, that critical application couldn't be used, they can always revert back to their regular machine running Windows 7 and be able to access the application. So there's tons of ways of doing it, and it's important to have that same kind of that ring methodology that we've built up inside of Windows Insider so that you can start expanding out into the whole organization. And one of the things I always find interesting is the cultural change aspect from that. As soon as you start rolling it out, you'll start to find that people really want to get onto the latest version of the operating system. They want those new features. And it's nice as an IT guy to be able to turn around and be able to actually hand them the thing that they want eventually. It's usually a good way to get buy-in into any program inside of IT.
Yeah. You want to kind of move from the I am the IT guy who just fixes broken things to I'm the IT guy that provides new functionality that I can use to make my life better.
Yeah. In terms of the kind of the upgrades to infrastructure that are actually kind of needed in order to be able to work through this, and we've had quite a bunch of questions around activation actually coming through the Q&A as well. So let's just deal with these. Some folks have been asking, do I need the latest version of Windows Server before I roll out Windows 10? Do I need to have the latest group policy settings applied to my domain controllers? What do we actually kind of need to be thinking about here?
Yeah, we do have new activation keys for the new OS, so certainly we do need to update your existing KMS servers. For server 2012 R2, we released a hotfix a couple of months ago that add that support. The keys are available on the Volume License Servicing Center as of August 1st, so you can get those and use those. There is going to be a hotfix for Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2 to add KMS support for Windows 10 to those as well, but that's not available yet. That should come out by October. Mm-hmm. For most people, the process to support Windows 10 really is just going to be updating your KMS. You don't need to update Active Directory. You don't need to do any type of schema or functional level changes. It should be just fine. There will be new group policy templates. Actually, they're already published, so
yeah, you can
download those now. We published a new KB yesterday as well that explains how to take the downloaded ADMX bundle, mm-hmm. kind of a, I think it's an actual installer, but it's just a bunch of files, and update your sysvol for your central policy store and group policy. So you take all those files, you update your domain controllers with the latest ADMX policy templates, and now you have the new policies from Windows 10 available to you. So fairly smooth process to go through.
Yeah, and there's a, I can't remember the link off the top of my head, there's a great website out there that runs on top of Azure websites that actually allows you to go through and just drill in and see what exact group policy settings are available. That's actually back-ended by basically an Excel spreadsheet, which lists all of the group policy settings, and you can drill into lots of detail as to what group policy settings are new for Windows 10. And there's some pretty useful new features in there to be able to kind of enable or disable certain things that you might want some extra control over inside of the operating system. So tons and tons of stuff out there. You do just need to do a little bit of searching to locate some of those things. In terms of MDOP as well, lots of folks are going to be using the Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack. What's kind of happening there?
We will have updates coming for all the MDOP products. We're really close, not available yet today, but within the coming days, we'll have a new MDOP release with new service packs for all the different tools. So fairly easy to update those for adding full support for Windows 10. AGPM gets updated with some new PowerShell commands. AppV has some new capabilities in the version 5.1 to make sequencing and other operations simpler. Dart adds support for the new version of Windows PE. Mm-hmm. MBAM is primarily a maintenance release, but does add some minor enhancements there as well. And UEV is primarily just a service pack as well. So none of them should be hard to deploy, but you will need to deploy the updates to have full Windows 10 support.
And in terms of some of the other things that have happened, I think there's going to be a lot of folks out there that might have gone for some of those lower cost devices inside of the enterprise that have very little storage capacity. What kind of things have we done there?
We had a feature in Windows 8.1 called WimBoot that enabled you to put Windows on a device that had a very small hard drive, 16 gig hard drive or 32 gig. And we could save a couple of gig of disk space in the process. With Windows 10, we've evolved that. So now it's not using the same structure, but behind the scenes, it's really using the same technology. It's just much easier to deploy. The new setup in Windows 10, we call it Compact OS. Basically, it's just a switch that you specify when applying an image using DISM to tell it to compress the OS as it's being applied to the disk. Behind the scenes, it's compressing the files, it's putting them into alternate data streams and hidden NTFS files, so the end result is still multiple gigabytes of free disk savings, but it's trivial to deploy compared to what it took to do WinBoot. For organizations that are buying devices that have very small disks, you're going to find with Windows 10 that they're shipped like this, just to give you more free disk space. But if you do need to deploy a custom image or redeploy an image to these machines, you'll be able to do that as well, leveraging the DISM support for that.
And what happens if you run setup.exe on a device which is already running a WinBooted installation? Do you get a compact OS automatically, or do you need to use the compact switch?
It will detect an existing WinBoot installation and do the compacting automatically. You can, if you want, run compact.exe from a command line. There are command line switches to enable that on any machine. So with WinBoot, we required UEFI and didn't support it in VMs, and there were a bunch of other restrictions. But with Windows 10, it really doesn't matter. You can turn it on any machine. That said, it's not going to buy you anything on machines with larger disks. It's really designed for those 16 and 32 gig machines. The other interesting thing is upgrading these. Mm. So if you've got a machine with 16 gig of disk space, like these little 7 and 8 inch tablets running Windows 8.1, you need 8 to 10 gig of free disk space to do an upgrade. It can be less for x86, but for x64, it's in that 8 gig range. On a lot of these, they don't have 8 gig of free disk space. They might have had that initially, but then you installed apps and synchronized your cloud storage down to the device, and mm-hmm. pretty soon you're left with just a few gig of free disk space. So how do you upgrade one of those? So we needed to add support into the upgrade process to recognize that and say, we don't have enough space to do it in place on the drive, but if you give us a USB drive, we'll leverage that. Because we need to keep a copy of the existing OS just in case anything goes wrong that we can roll back. So we'll actually copy the OS to a USB drive, then put the new Windows 10 down on the existing 16 gig drive. And you can keep that that other drive around for recovery purposes for maybe the first month, just in case you want to revert back. So you will see that, especially on consumer upgrades for these devices, when you go through Windows Update. If it doesn't detect enough disk space, it'll pop up a dialog and say, hey, I can upgrade you if you give me a USB drive.
That's actually a really cool feature. I hadn't realized that we were doing that. It's pretty impressive. What about in terms of being able to reset and refresh the machines? We actually saw that kind of capability come in with Windows 8, but I'm guessing it's changed a little bit because we've changed the way that we're doing our upgrades.
Yeah, and also we wanted to free up even more disk space.
Yeah.
With most Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 devices, OEMs would ship the device with a separate recovery partition, and they put their complete image onto that, which could be 4 or 5 gig of disk space eaten up on the disk, just in case you ever wanted to reset it back to the factory configuration. With Windows 10, we don't do that anymore. With Windows 10, OEMs will ship the devices without a recovery image. They'll ship it with Windows 10 on it, but you'll still be able to reset it. So when you do a reset, it will reconstruct the OS from the side-by-side store inside of the Windows directory. It'll completely reconstitute a fresh install of Windows. That has an interesting implication because, well, what about the other stuff that OEMs added on top? The drivers, the hardware configuration utilities, and the other stuff that you needed to use the device. So the OEMs will build provisioning packages that we talked a little bit about before. Those provisioning packages can be embedded in that OEM machine and automatically reapplied as part of the reset process. So no full recovery image with all that stuff baked in, just a provisioning package, which might be a gig or two, with the OEM customizations to Windows 10. And then the rest of the OS is rebuilt from the side-by-side store with all the patches. So you don't have to reinstall all the patches after doing that. It will be rebuilt using the patched OS. It will actually discard the last month of updates because you might be resetting it to deal with an issue that was caused within the last month. So we'll discard driver updates and patches and other changes that have been made within the last month. But everything else before that, all of the cumulative updates that we've released will be there. So you won't immediately have to apply a year's worth of servicing after you reset the machine. You'll already be up to date.
Awesome. That's actually a really, really clever way of being able to deliver that kind of process. So in terms of resources for these folks to be able to go and kind of explore a little bit of this at the moment, a few things that you've thrown up on the slide there, AKMS/Explore10, giving you some options for being able to go and look at presumably what's happening inside of Windows 10, Deploy10. Presumably that's a bunch of deployment resources.
Yeah, everything points to TechNet. So we've published documentation on TechNet to explain how to deploy Windows 10, starting with documentation available today on how to do the traditional wipe and load type deployments. But we will be adding in-place upgrade step-by-steps for MDT and Config Manager probably in the next week or two, corresponding with the MDT 2013 Update 1 release and really just catching up on the sheer backlog of all the documentation that we're working on for Windows 10.
Yeah. And also there's the Windows for Business section of Microsoft.com where you can go and find out a bunch more information as well. And we're going to take a short biological break. Everyone can go and grab a cup of coffee or whatever beverage it is in your time zone, and then come back and we'll run through some more information on Windows as a service and the servicing aspect. We've just looked at how you get from other operating systems onto this track of being inside of a operating system that runs the service. Now we're going to give you some more information on how actually servicing is going to work and how you can get some control over it. So come back in just a couple of moments.